Welcome everyone to this WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is ODM Real Execution Server Configuration and Tuning. Today's presenter is Frank Delport. Frank has over 12 years of experience working with ODM and JRealz as a consultant and product expert. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Frank.
Hello everyone. Yes, I will be making this presentation about ODM Role Execution Server. Can we move on to the introduction, slide number two? So this presentation is going to touch many different topics of ODM. We will talk about the common options of configuration, deployment, and integration of RES. We will give some performance and troubleshooting tips. And throughout, we will try to emphasize on the newer features of RES, things that have been introduced more recently, I would say, because there is a previous presentation that was done a couple years ago about JRealz Rule Execution Server. So there is a link on this slide, and it was focusing a little bit more on libraries and packaging, and as well as class loading issues. So I think that's a good reference presentation for earlier versions of the product, but it's still a good reference today as well. And in this presentation, we focus on slightly newer features. So moving to slide three, so the agenda is going to be many different topics. So execution patterns, what are the most common topologies of deploying RES, what are the management stack capabilities, and we'll end with some performance and troubleshooting tips. So slide four, the first execution pattern, the most common one, is that of using the POJO REST session library and embed that in your application. So looking at the diagram here, and most of the diagrams in this presentation are going to be using sort of the same color scheme. So in a red-ish color, we have the application server. And in light blue, you have your application. It's called My Web Application. It's something that you've built and for which you have an executable object model, your own code and classes that you've bundled with that application. And you will be able to do RES rule set executions by bundling the RES POJO session library in your web application. That will use the JCA API to look up actually a RES execution unit, so that the RES XU in this diagram, and that RES XU is going to retrieve rule sets from the database, what we call the RES DB. And optionally, you can have the RES management console deployed. I say optionally because technically this could work without the console. You would just not be able to do hot deployment, for example, and you would not get much monitoring information about the execution, but it would still work. You should still be able to request execution of rule sets from your client application, even if the management console is not there. Now, the management console is exposed to HTTP, so an administrator can view and pause it and see statistics and do hot deployment, and it interacts with the execution unit through JMX API. So the reason I mentioned that, we'll talk a little bit more later about management, so that's why I mentioned that there is a JMX API that allows for the RES console to notify the XU that some new rule set has been deployed, for example, and also to receive statistics about the execution unit, how many times the rule set has been executed, and so forth. Now, both the management console and the execution unit are going to use JDBC to retrieve rule sets from the RES DB. Now, what's a little bit newer in this with version 7.5 of the product and later is that the use of MyManageZone. So that's basically the capability in RES to store your code, your classes, your domain classes, to have them stored in the database so that they are loaded on the fly along with the rule set so that execution can proceed from there. So that gives greater flexibility. That way you don't necessarily have to package your ZOM inside the web application. Now, in this diagram, there's both a regular bundled ZOM and a managed ZOM. Actually, you can use either or both of these options. note that your REST application, your client application, at the moment that it does the invocation, it will need to have the parameters loaded in the JVM and before it invokes the rule set. So for that, it means that the rule set parameters, they need to be in classes of types that are classes in your bundled ZOM and not in the managed ZOM, because it will be too late to retrieve the ZOM from the database if you need to have them objects already instantiated to pass as argument to the rule set. Another point is that even if you have, let's say, the same class deployed in ZOM and in managed ZOM, you will not override the ZOM class, the regular bundled ZOM class, with the managed ZOM class. That's because that's the class loading policy. If you bundle a certain version of a class with your application, that's what's going to be used. So if you want to use something that's managed, you should not bundle the equivalent class in your web application. Now you see that in the darker blue components, those are RES components, the session library, the management console, the XU, and the database. We insist that the version should match as much as possible, because otherwise you will see warnings that, you know, the components are not at the same levels, and that in particular notifications, for example, may fail. So you will not be able to do hot deploy of rule set because the management console is not going to recognize the XU very well. So it's very important to have components that are at the same patch level, down to the same patch level, for example, 8011 for every single component here, or 850, but similarly, every single component being at that level. This is going to become even more important with 851 because with the new generation of the engine, it's going to be even more sensitive to the versions of the libraries. So that's it for this slide. Moving on to slide 5, another very popular execution pattern is that of HTTPS. That's what we call the short name for Hosted Transparent Decision Service. So that's a very popular execution pattern because it's very simple. It's possible to expose a web service without having any Java code deployed, really. You just need to have a sort of an XML schema, and that gives you the model, and you can start writing rules with that. And there is, you know, you're basically able to expose a web service without having written a single line of Java code. So that makes it a very popular feature. Still with that deployment, so you see the deployment is similar. Instead of having your own custom web application, you have the RES HTTPS application that's deployed. You can still bundle your ZOM with it. You can still use managed ZOM, and you can still, and of course, with HTTPS, we have what we call dynamic ZOM, which is the schemas, the XML schemas. So all those three different types of ZOM are available with HTTPS. And in the case of dynamic and managed, that simplifies very much versioning because you can have those ZOM bundled in the database in different versions and bundled alongside the rule apps, so that when you request a particular rule app, it can load all its dependencies and you don't have to worry about which classes need to be loaded and which schema needs to be loaded with this, because it's already, all those dependencies are already handled. So that's relatively recent that HTTPS supports the ZOM, the Java classes. So it means also that you may need to use JAXB annotations in your Java ZOM. So it's, for example, I would say for inheritance, if you have a class, an abstract class, and several subclasses, with JAXB, you may need to add some annotations to list all the possible subclasses so that the JAXB layer can properly serialize and deserialize those objects. And for that, it may need to know all the possible subclasses of a given class. So, for example, I think there's an annotation XML C also. And that's the type of annotation that you might need to put in there in your ZOM. To have a properly functioning web service. But then again, you don't have to. You can also use just a regular schemas to create your web service. Now, fairly new as well is the ability to expose the web service as SOAP. That's been out there for a while, but also now as REST, as is very popular in the mobile world, is to have REST web services. So that is now in the product as well, so you can request executions with that. And another thing to say about HDS is that if you're migrating from earlier versions of the product, especially from 7.1 or 7.0, it's possible that you were using a compatibility flag back then. So if you were using a 7.1.1.3 compatibility flag, then that's what you might need to do today if you want to keep seeing everything as is. That's the value you will use. But if you were not using any flag back when we were using 7.1, then the flag that you need to use is V7.1. That will bring your that will make HTTPS behave the same way in 8.5 as it was in Jeru 7.1. So that might help if you have some web service clients that are already configured and expecting the web service to have a certain signature. I mean, in this case, if you don't want to make any changes, that's what you would use the compatibility flag for. Now, the flag 7.1.3 was introduced a few years back. That was to introduce a new behavior that's actually to make it work a little better with a BPM product. So that's a flag that you might have used back then to work more nicely with BPM. But then in later on versions, that 7.1.3 behavior became the default one. Moving on to slide 6. So the third type of very popular execution pattern is to have sort of a batch applications that use an MDB. So we provide a RES MDB that you can embed in your batch application. So as in this diagram, so again, you would bundle your ZOM with the batch application, and the RES MDB has the session library to interact with the XU. So in this case, we do provide the ability to have the rule set parameters be of classes that are in managed ZOM. So the RES MDB is built in such a way that you can pass objects that are in serialized form in the MQ, in the JMS message. They're in serialized form. At the moment we deserialize those objects, we can actually use the managed ZOM. So that makes it extremely flexible in terms of versioning, because you can request a particular version of a rule set and actually to deserialize the parameters that are going to be passed to that rule set, we will use the managed ZOM, which can be of a specific version for that rule app and rule set version. So that's a pretty flexible feature. And again, the managed ZOM does not override the ZOM that you bundle. So you need to be mindful of the fact that if you bundle some ZOM libraries, they will be the one version that gets used. And another thing to say about this is we've seen the MDB is sometimes very often used for a batch application. And for that, in the interest of performance, you might want to process more than one rule set execution per message. And that's when the RES MDB becomes a little bit limited, because it's by contract, it's just a way of exposing your rule set execution as an MDB. So each request, each message will be for just one rule set execution. And if you're using MDB for a batch, it could be that you want to do millions or hundreds of thousands or millions of executions, and it might help to have more than one rule set execution request per message, because that would reduce the chattiness of the whole application. And so for that type of situation, we tend to recommend that you implement your own RES MDB. That way, in the implementation of the MDB, you can actually, in the payload of the message, you can have multiple requests, multiple items in the batch that are to be processed. And then you can loop through those and execute and make execution to the to execution server, so that you minimize the network overhead of processing one transaction at a time. So for that sort of thing, we document, and there's a link in that page to implement your own ResMDB. Now moving on to slide 7, now that we've seen the most common execution patterns, there are other execution patterns. There is MTDS that used to be a sort of a viable option, but nowadays, because HTDS has gained many features with the managed ZOM and the ability to sort of publish a web service without having to generate an application, really. HTTPS has become so popular that MTDS is a bit less relevant. It's still needed if you want to get greater control over the service signature, because in HTTPS, the service signature is sort of generated directly from the rule set parameters. With MTDS, it is a little bit more freedom of modifying things, but it's much more much heavier development process, because you need to generate an application from Rule Designer based on the wizard, and then you deploy that to your environment. So we have a tech note that explains the pros and cons of choosing between HTDS and MTDS, and for earlier versions of the product, I think we recommend that you use a tech note that we have a different, slightly different implementation of MTDS for WAS 7. So that's for MTDS. There is also Java SE type of execution patterns. That's especially used by our customers for batch, because there's no, when you do batch, you don't necessarily need to have a full application server running. So we have a few people using that, and it's getting even more viable now that we have some additional support nowadays through the TCP/IP management mode that I will be discussing in a few slides. That makes some sort of clustering available to Java SE as well, even though, you know, before that, management mode that I will be talking about. Before that mode, there was really no clustering support for Java SE, so that makes it a bit of a better option now. And finally, the last integration option that really less and less frequent nowadays is to use the low-level API, the ILR context and ILR ruleset API. That is to bypass RES altogether, so that we have less and less people using that, and especially with the new version of the engine coming out, this API is not even going to be the one that that lets you execute rules, because there's a new decision engine coming up. So in this case, so this is probably less recommended at this point. So now that we've seen execution patterns, we're moving on to common topologies. So slide 8. So some of the most common topologies are what's documented as the gold topology is a sort of a cluster of RES execution units, of RES applications, I would say. And we'll discuss the difference between clustered and non-clustered console, because there are some questions and issues around that, so I'm going to spend a few slides on this. Another very popular topology is the HTDS, the deployment of HTDS in a load balance setup. Then a couple of variations on topologies are about having the execution unit application scoped, and that is bundled with other applications. So that's a variation in topology that I will discuss. And then we'll finish with the situation with multiple RES configurations and what are your options when you want to deploy several RES configurations in your setup. So slide number 9, we talk about the gold topology and with the non-clustered console. This is really the setup that has been used for the past few years, and the one in the next slide is actually something that's more recent, and that comes with some limitations. So that's why we want to focus on this first one, and say that it's still probably a good recommendation to go with that setup, because that is how we've been recommending that you set up your gold topology before. So In this diagram, you see that we have one cell, which is typically, for example, for WebSphere, that's the scope of the management of the deployment manager. So it will have visibility on the whole cell. That is, it will manage a number of nodes. So in this case, we have a couple of nodes here, node 1 and node 2. And for each node, we have a number of application servers. And you see that we've defined a cluster of RES servers. In that cluster, there's basically your application that is deployed, and that application bundles the REST client library. Whether it's the POJO or the MDB, it does not matter. Here is just to say that you have a REST-enabled, I would say, application that is deployed as a cluster. And what we recommend is to have the REST management console deployed on a single server versus the management console being deployed on the cluster itself. So that has been what we recommend. You want to have the RES execution unit deployed at the node level. So for each node, you have the RES XU. We also recommend that the data source must be defined at the node level. Now, when you have a setup like this, you could say that the RES management console, if it goes down, there's only one instance of it. So you could say that this is less fault tolerant. That may be true, but the thing is, if the RES management console goes down, you can still have regular executions that are still going to take place. As I mentioned in the first slide, the management console is sort of optional. It does not prevent execution from happening. So you can still have a path from your application that uses the REST client library and that connects to the XU to do the rule execution, the rule set executions. That will still work even if the management console is down. The only thing that will not work without the management console is the hot deploy. So what we usually say is that if the management console is down, you probably need to fix that before you proceed to deploy a new version of rule set. So in practice, it's not really a problem for most of our customers to have the management console as a single server versus a clustered management console. So that's why that remains the setup that we recommend. Now you can have the management console on a dedicated server, or you could have it in one server that is part of the cluster, but still not the management console itself, not targeting the cluster. The point being that to avoid any limitation of the management console, you should have a single instance of it in the whole cell. So that was it for the non-clustered console. Now moving to slide 10. We see that this is the same diagram, but this time we've made the management console added it to the cluster. So in this case, we do have some sort of fault tolerance, and this is what's documented in ODM 8.5. That's what you will find in the documentation. To a certain extent, it simplifies a few things. Like it will have better fault tolerance, and it will also simplify SSP clustering, which I'm going to elaborate on in the next slide. But it does come with limitations, because in this setup, you will not be able to do interceptors, or you will not be able to do management sessions. Because basically, by design, the management console can only be used effectively by clients if there is a single one in the whole cell. That's why having more than one will cause problems with interceptor type execution and with management session. So there is a link that on this slide that takes you to the details of the limitations that you would be hitting with several consoles. And moving to the next slide, so I was saying that this deployment with multiple REST console does simplify the SSP deployment, because in the case where you have a single management console, you do need to have to implement what we call an ILR SSP resolver if you are going to use a cluster of RES SSP. So that is one, I would say that is the one tricky thing about having a single management console is in the case where you are going to use SSP or DVS and you need to deploy the SSP on multiple servers. This is the situation where having a single console makes things a little bit more complicated because you need for decision center to be able to point to the right SSP resolver based on because in decision center you will be configuring a number of REST servers, and for those REST servers, if you want to make sure that for different REST server configuration you hit different SSPs, you need to implement an SSP resolver. So that's some custom code that you need to implement to make sure that you use a different and that you can load, I mean, that you can leverage multiple SSP deployments. So that, I would say, is the only drawback of using a standalone management console. So moving to slide 12. Another very popular topology is to use HTTP load balancing with HTTPS. So that's a very popular setup. You have multiple servers where HTTPS is deployed, and you have an HTTP load balancer in front and some web service clients that connect to HTTP load balancer. And so the one thing that that you need to be mindful of is that you may need to go to the management console and configure the web service endpoint, because from the web service client, you will need to be the clients need to be pointing to the HTTP load balancer versus each individual server. So there is a configuration in the REST management console for you to give a different web service endpoint to the web service that is exposed by HTTPS. Moving to slide 13. Now, here we're discussing a variation in topology, which is to have an application scope execution unit. So, like we saw in the previous diagrams, we had the execution unit deployed at the node level on each individual node. And that would make it available for all the servers that are deployed on that node and visible to all the servers in that node. So in particular, if you want server 1 and server 2 to be using two different versions of RES, you will not be able to do that because you really, at the node level, you can only deploy one version of anything, really. So that is one reason why you would want to do application scope, is if you want to deploy multiple, if you want to deploy different versions of ODM inside the same cell. So in this case, you might want to bundle the execution unit with your application so that you can bundle different versions of the execution unit with different applications. So that's one motivation. Another motivation to use the application scope XU is to solve some third-party library conflict. It happens that, you know, it sometimes happens that the libraries that are bundled with the XU, they may conflict with other things in your application, so, and in, with the application server or with things that you've deployed. So in this case, what you can do is put the execution unit in your web application and use the parent last class loading option. That makes it sort of an application that has its own version of all the classes, so that may help avoid any conflict with other library versions. So that's one main motivation for the for deploying the XU application scope. Another motivation will be for people who want to deploy a sort of a self-contained application. So we've seen people who don't really want to have a step that involves deploying a RAR file. They just want to be able to deploy an EAR application and undeploy it and have all its dependencies bundled with it. So that's another situation where you might want to bundle the XU. Now, It does come with some, in the case of deploying multiple ODM version, and that's what I list in this slide, is if you are going to use that application scope zoo for the purpose of deploying multiple version of the product, it is going to come with a bit of complications with configuration. You will need to give distinct names for the XUs, and you will need to configure the management console so that each management console can only see the XUs that it's supposed to see. So if you have two different versions, you want a certain version to only see the execution units that correspond to that version. So those are two things that already that you need to tune. You also need to be mindful of all the data source and zoo connection factories. You will not be able to use the default names that that we recommend in the documentation. You will have to make sure that their names reflect, you know, what version you're going to use, just so that you can separate them. So that creates quite a bit of complication. But if that's really what you need to do, it is an option. And in the end, you will still be left with some limitations about having multiple management consoles. So again, in the situation where you deploy, when you use this application scope XU for the purpose of deploying several versions of the product, if you have several management consoles, you will still have the limitations that I mentioned about having the management console. So that's it for this topology variation here. Moving to slide 14. Now, another question, set of questions we have about topology is, what should we do with multiple REST configurations? Let's say you have a dev, QA, prod environment that you want to set up. How should you set it up? Another similar question is, if you have a REST deployment for, let's say, the people who are doing pricing in your company, and you want to have another REST deployment that needs to be strictly isolated from the people doing pricing, because the pricing rules need to be really isolated and not seen from anybody else. So basically, you need to do a completely isolated deployment of REST. So those are two similar requests to have multiple REST deployment. And so in this slide, I'm trying to contrast the option to have everything in one cell versus having a dedicated cell per environment and per isolated REST deployment. And the point is that we really recommend the option on the right-hand side. The option on the right-hand side is not fully fleshed out. It's avoiding the detail, but it's just a summary of saying this: the option of having a dedicated cell for QA, dedicated cell for prod, is going to be a lot more straightforward than using the same cell and trying to have within that one cell a number of separate REST deployments, be it for QA versus prod, or pricing rules, pricing rule application versus eligibility rule application, you see. So the reason I'm saying this is because on the left-hand side, you see that, let's say, for the setup of the QA environment, you will have the whole stack of the database, the XU, the management console, and your own application. And all those things have dependencies and GNDI and resource references, and all of those will need to be tuned very very carefully because they will need to be different for each setup. And also, you will need to have each management console filter out which zoo it is seeing. So the same thing, you will need to be using something called a JMX underscore zoo underscore query part. This is a filtering mechanism that you configure for the management console that limits its visibility to the zoos. So all those things you will need to configure just so that you can separate the different REST configurations. So again, this slide, it's mostly to say we tend to recommend you give a dedicated sell for each res deployment. Moving to slide 15. Now, a few words about the management capabilities of the product. So we mentioned that the res console is the web interface that lets you do interactive management of res, but it's relying on JMX API, and it's exposing a lot of its functionality through JMX and Beans, so you can interact programmatically with those, and so you can use that to monitor events. When anything is done on the management console, you can receive events from the JMX notification mechanism. You can also use the JMX API for the deployment automation. So that's one set of API. You can use also the res ant task to do some deployment automation. And since ODM 801, we have the REST API that lets you do deployment automation as well, and also gives you fine-grained control of the res repository. In slide 16, we give a diagram. Again, the different options of interacting with the management stack of the product. So you can have a res administrator directly interacting with the web console. You can have REST clients, and that will interact with the REST console over HTTP as well. You can have res ant tasks that are going to interact as well with over HTTP. And you can have programmatic JMX clients that would interact with the JMX and beans of the management console. And in this case, they can also receive notifications going back. So you can receive, you can have sort of a program that receives notifications like this. And so that's for the interface, the clients to the management console. And then internally, by default, the management console, it interacts with the execution unit through JMX as well. So that makes it, in particular in the case of WebSphere and also many other application servers, that the scope of the JMX API is usually that of a cell, a single cell. And so that makes it, to some customers, that becomes a bit of a limitation, because that's the JMX notifications will not be able to cross the boundaries of a cell. So that is one of the reasons why we introduce another management mode. So that's in slide 17. So in slide 17, we see that there was, since 8.01 and also in 8.5, we started introducing the TCP/IP mode. So compared to the previous diagram, you see that all the usual ways of interacting with the management console and the management stack, all those are still available. It's the same thing. It's over HTTP and maybe over JMX if you want to interact with the management console through a remote JMX client. All those things on the left-hand side, they're still there. But what changes with the TCP/IP mode is between the XU and the management console, there is now going to be TCP/IP, instead of the JMX API. So by TCP, I mean TCP/IP is a bit of a it's a bit vague, but it's what it means is we implemented our own proprietary protocol between the console and the XU, and the requirement is just to have TCP/IP that works between those two. That's what it is. The slide is not comparing JMX with TCP/IP. It's just saying that here the only requirement for this to work is to have a TCP/IP stack between that works, and that makes the console visible to the XUs and back. So, and this mode, and as is represented in this diagram, it makes it possible to cross the boundary of a cell. So you see there is a cell A and a cell B, and you could have a management console deployed in one cell, and it manages execution units that are in a different WebSphere cell. So that's something that was requested by customers and who are dealing with multiple WAS cells. Because really, as probably tried to explain in a previous slide, the scope of RES is really that of a single cell, most of the time. That's really what it was designed for, all the management capabilities and so forth, and the visibility and the preference to have one management console inside the cell and a single management console in the cell. All this says that, you know, it works better by having just one cell. But here, this is a way to cross cell boundaries. Now, that's the story for Java EE, but this capability also gives you new flexibility with Java SE, because Java SE normally does not have any notion of clustering. It's just standalone JVMs. But with this proprietary protocol that we have, you can now deploy standalone JVMs that are with, and each JVM contains an execution unit, and you can have the TCP/IP mode enabled and have a management console that actually manages those standalone JVM, or at least it manages the execution unit in all those standalone JVMs. So that's some sort of clustering support for Java SE. Moving to slide 18. So as I mentioned, we'll talk about we'll end this presentation with a couple of with performance and troubleshooting tips. So in terms of performance, some of the most common concerns are listed here. Is very often when we have performance questions, it boils down to an algorithm choice. That's very frequent. I'm not saying it's always the case, but we have many situations where the use of RETI Plus was not adequate based on the number of rules and the amount of data that has to be processed. RETI Plus has its advantages sometimes for a sort of stateful data-driven evaluations, but for a lot of business applications, the FastPath and sequential algorithm are much faster. So that's usually one of the first things to look at, is are you using the right algorithm? Now, the second concern is the I/O overhead, and to be mindful of the overall application and how much time is spent in I/O before, after, and during whole set execution. We had a situation where the customer was was concerned of the performance of HTTPS, and we were measuring milliseconds here on HTTPS, and we were trying to improve, from 20 milliseconds to 15 milliseconds and things like that. But in the end, what the customer was complaining about was waiting for minutes, and that's because it's not the web service that was slow. It's just the fact that from the end-user application, they were, for a single interaction, there were about 100 web service requests that were made to HTTPS. And all those requests had to go through a gateway that had to do some authentication. And so that created a huge amount of chattiness between the end-user application and the web service. So in the end, all the time, the minute that was that the users were spending waiting, that was corresponded to time spent on the network almost exclusively. So it really helps to have to have an understanding of the big picture of where the time is spent and how much I/O is used throughout the application, and to see exactly where. And to see if really the performance of rule set execution is a factor or not. And here in this case, it's not. Even if you improve from 20 milliseconds to 15 milliseconds, it doesn't change the fact that people are going to wait a minute over network chats. So that's the second top concern. Then a very frequent question is about rule set parsing and the fact that it is a resource-intensive step. The parsing of a rule set, and that will cause some slowdown of an application, some high CPU utilization of a server and things like that. So we do have a few questions about that, so I'll talk about it more in the next few slides. Same thing, the memory footprint. At some point, if you're using up too much memory, you will slow down and it might cause performance problem of the JVM. Because once you run out of heap, you will see a lot more garbage collection, and that will slow everything down. So that's why it's listed here under performance, is that the memory footprint is something you want to look at as well if you see some performance issues. another tip on performance is to use Java ZOM. It's usually faster than dynamic ZOM if you're really concerned over milliseconds and really as fast executing rules as fast as possible, then you want to go towards Java ZOM. You want to tune another very common concern is about the connection pool size for the JCA, for the XU connection factory. So the default values, they are typically good for 1, 2, 3 rule sets. But if you have dozens of rule sets and you have a lot of concurrency, a lot of concurrent accesses to the to those rule sets, then the connection pool size may need to be increased because there is just one connection pool for a number of rule sets usually, and so the default values may not be good if you start having a high level of concurrency on those rule sets and maybe a lot of rule sets as well. So you might want to tune that. Same thing for HTTPS. So HTTPS has when it deserializes the XML and serializes it back, it's using a set of objects that's called the document driver. So and that object is managed in a pool because those objects cannot be used concurrently. So there is a pool size for that for those document drivers. So if your HTTPS web services is dealing with very large XML and a lot of time is spent just parsing the XML and generating XML, then it means the document driver, that set of, that object is going to be heavily used. And so in this case, you might want to increase the pool size for the HTTPS document driver. And finally, when you use Decision Warehouse, there's a couple of things that will help is because Decision Warehouse can log a huge amount of trace, and that may have a huge impact on performance. So we recommend that you use monitoring filters to reduce the size of the trace. And if you want to avoid having an impact on transaction and on the round trip transaction, you can log the trace asynchronously. There is a link that you can click in this slide. It will take you to a sample that allows to do that. So those are the top performance concerns. Going to slide 19, we spend some more time on the impact of rule set parsing. As I said, we have many customers who see that this high CPU spike, maybe at startup, maybe at later time, maybe during around the time of a hot deployment of a rule set, or maybe after a long period of inactivity. Those are situations where a rule set parsing can occur, and it will it may take a while. It may lead the transaction to timeout if you're waiting for the parsing to complete before the transaction can proceed. These sort of situations become performance concerns for customers. So what we recommend is that first you use asynchronous rule set parsing. So that will help in the case of hot deployments to make sure that at the moment that the rule set is a new rule set is deployed, you will continue to use the old rule set as long as the new one is still being parsed. And as soon as it's ready to be used, then the request for transaction can use the newly parsed rule set. That way there is no transaction that's actually incurring the cost of rule set parsing. And so all transactions can basically complete within the same amount of time. So use asynchronous rule set parsing. During startup, we recommend that you do a preload, which is to avoid that the first few requests are going to incur the cost of rule set parsing. You can forcefully do your own load and preload by using the API. So that's for startup time. And then there is the last option, the third option listed here is to use the rule set max idle time. That is one way to make sure that the rule set is always going to stay in the cache. That helps with situations where after some inactivity on the rule set, the rule set becomes evicted from the cache, and the next time around you need to execute it, then it needs to be parsed again. So for this type of situation, we recommend that you use max idle time. That will allow you to control how long The rule set is going to stay in the cache. So if you set it to zero, it will always stay in the cache. So it comes with, you need to be careful with that, because if you do some hot deployments, then it means that even the old version is going to stay there forever if you don't replace. So you need to be mindful of these things if you do hot deployment. You want to be careful, but it's, in general, it's a good option here to make sure that you don't have a rule set that, because of some inactivity around it, maybe overnight inactivity, then becomes evicted from the cache, and the next time around you execute it, it takes a little too long to execute. So those are the recommendation to reduce the impact of rule set parsing. You can see there's a link as well for some more details about minimizing this impact. And there's a note that HTTPS does not use asynchronous parsing. So if you want to avoid users waiting for a particular rule set execution, in particular after it's been hot deployed, for example, or at startup, then you need to implement your own load. So you need to initiate your own web service request, maybe once at startup and once during a hot deploy, to make sure that the web service is exercised at least once before actual web service requests from actual clients are being processed. Moving to slide 20. As I mentioned, the memory footprint can have an impact on performance. If you have many rules, then you can start seeing that the rule set memory footprint, it starts being noticeable on the heap size of the JVM. I would say if you have dozens, if you have hundreds of rules, that's not a problem. But when you start having thousands of rules, that's when you start seeing a noticeable memory footprint. And so what we recommend is that you are extremely mindful of the property rule set .bomb.enabled. So that property is set automatically to true by a decision center, and more so it's going to be in the product, is going to be set to true, because it does come with it allows for certain features in DVS for testing and things like that. But for actual transaction processing, it's not really needed, and it does have a cost in terms of memory footprint. So we recommend that you're very mindful of that property and set it to false in any setup where you're not using DVS and you're just looking for the lowest memory footprint you can get. So, and in this case, you would set this property to false. So you want to set it to false as much as possible to minimize your footprint. And the other thing we would say about reducing memory footprint is to avoid parsing rule sets simultaneously. If you have a chance to parse the rule set in sequence, that will help because there's a bit of a spike in memory footprint at the moment that the rule set parsing takes place. And if you do it for all rule sets at the same time, that will do a fairly large spike in memory usage of the JVM. Like I said, this is mostly for thousands of rules. There is obviously the option to increase the heap memory, or to reduce the number of rules and or create smaller, more discrete rule sets if you want to avoid issues with rule set memory footprint. Now, it's to be noted that in 8.5.1 there's going to be a new decision engine that should reduce drastically the memory footprint. So that's going to be a completely different approach. And it should very much reduce this issue. So moving to slide 21, give an example of the use of the property rule set bomb enabled and the staggering of rule set parsing versus doing all rule set parsing at the same time. So here we see the example of, in red, is the worst case scenario is you're parsing two rule sets at the same time with rule set bomb enabled to true. That means you're going to start using a lot of memory, and you're going to keep, even long time after parsing, you'll still have a lot of memory usage. So that is because, in particular, of rule set bomb enable being true. If you set it to false, you will see in the orange graph that at least once the parsing is done for both rule sets, then there's a lot of memory that gets returned back to the JVM because you've used the rule set bomb enable false. And then the best option is to actually, to do the rule set parsing in sequence and using rule set bomb enable false. That will give you the lowest profile of memory usage, you see, because you will still get a bit of a spike because of the parsing is sort of memory intensive itself. But with the property rule set bomb enable set to false, you will be able to return quite a bit of memory after the parsing is done. And so if you do that in sequence with the two rule sets, you're able to reduce the overall memory usage of the whole deployment. Moving to slide 22. So there are quite a few resources online about performance and REST performance, so I list them here and give some more detail. In the previous slide, I tried to emphasize the things that we see them having the most impact in most of the support questions that we get. Moving to slide 23, we'll finish with a few troubleshooting tips. So some of the more common occurrences for all the support questions we get is the top ones are listed here. I would say that, as I mentioned, the JMX API is very much used for management by default. And that JMX API requires some administrative privilege. So that's why in the product documentation, it's listed that you should configure the RES users to have administrative user role, to be a monitor or an administrator. And that is very often the case that the customers have not set that properly, and we run into authorization issues with RES. So that's one of the main concerns. Another situation is the presence of more than one REST console in the cell. As I explained, it comes with some limitations. So when you do interceptors or management sessions, you will have problems if you have more than one REST console in the cell. That's another usual suspect. The REST data source configuration, that's another source of problems. If you're using the wrong credentials, then you're not looking at the right schemas, for example. So the REST code is not going to be looking at the table, is not going to find the tables properly. So that happens when customers, I would say, have the database created by one user and then the credentials pass to somebody else. And in the end, they're not really using the credentials that really give visibility to the right set of tables. So in the end, REST does not find the tables and that gives problems. We also recommend the scope to be of the node-level scope for all the data source. And we recommend to use XA data source to avoid any issues with one-phase commit and, I mean, the enrollment of non-XA resource in a global transaction. Because it's not that REST does not work without that, but if you start using non-XA data source, then there is a greater risk that you start enrolling more than one non-XA data source or resource, and you end up running into transaction issues. And you also want to tune the connection pool, I would say, of the REST data source. So that was for item number three. The fourth, the most common issue RES has to do with the class loading policy for all the different components, for example, the management console or the SSP or HTDS, all those applications that are documented that you deploy, they typically require that you set the class loading policy to parent class, which is also known as classes loaded with local class loader first. That's very important. That's very often people miss that step, and that leads to some exception, and the application does not start properly. So you want to make sure this is set up right. And finally, very often we see questions about a rule set that cannot be parsed or it cannot be loaded, And so for that, you would look at the server log for likely a ZOM class that is missing from the package or the dynamic or the managed ZOM. So that's the number one situation, is you're simply missing a ZOM class. And with managed ZOM, there are now some complications that to make sure that the dependencies are correctly set between the rollup and the managed ZOM, you need to have a file called deployment.xml. You want to make sure that that file is deployed properly to Decision Center, for example, so that when a rule set is generated from Decision Center, all the proper dependencies are configured correctly. So that's another place to look for ZOM-related issue or things that would make your rule set fail to parse, is that if you have the dependencies and the class path configured wrong for your managed ZOM. Moving to slide 24, so when you have an issue, we recommend that you use the RES console diagnostic, and there are links that you can click on this site. RES console diagnostic, enable the RES console XU dump. That will take a snapshot of the execution unit and tell you how many rule sets are in the cache and other interesting statistics to know what is the connection pools, in particular the size of the connection pools and how many for each rule set and so forth. So that collects interesting information. You can also enable the debug level trace of the execution unit. That will give you information as well. And for class loading related issues, we recommend that you use minus verbose colon class as a common line argument to the JVM. That will tell you which classes are loaded from where. And sometimes that shows that certain classes, some of your classes or maybe some of the classes of the product, are not being loaded from the right location. That you realize that you put a library in a shared library location and it shouldn't be there. So that's one option here to troubleshoot this type of class loading issue that we sometimes ask, is the verbose class command line argument. Same thing, the verbose GC is useful for memory usage issues. And finally, for data collection, we also have a support assistant, an IBM support assistant called ISA, and you'll see in your product installation there is a in the start menu, you will find links that allow you to automatically collect data, relevant data, that will then help the support team troubleshoot things a little faster. And there's a link in this slide as well that gives you access to a web, something that is directly hosted on the web and that will do the data collection on your machine. Moving to slide 25. So hopefully with this presentation will help you choose the right execution pattern and topology and avoid some of the more common performance and basically usual suspects in terms of issues and problems with RES. When an issue occurs, please collect all the relevant data, server logs, and things that I listed in the previous slide, so that the support team can help you most efficiently. I think that concludes the presentation. Back to you, David.
Thank you, Frank, for a great presentation. Slide 26 has some additional WebSphere product resources that we hope you would find useful. At this time, we would like to open the lines for questions.
Currently, there are no questions in the queue.
Thank you. At this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation and hope you'll join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on this site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Frank, for presenting today.
Thank you.